Remember that picture? That's the only picture I have in my presentation. Okay. So remember that picture? Yeah. Oh, there it is. Okay, good. I think I have the record for the fewest pictures, right, next to the zero, yes. Seems to me that we can get principles from examples like this. This, in the larger scheme of things, this lobster fishing, of course, is just trivial. It's just a infinitesimally small piece of our economy. But it also seems to me that's not the point. The point is that this is a place where people have actually worked things out over time, such that the resource is not depleted, that it's healthy, that the communities are healthy as communities and economically healthy, and the state and the government that depends in part on its revenues. So here we have an example, as I said before, of restraint, respite, buffering. But we can find other examples as well. There's a little community in Spain called Valencia that has been... The other thing I didn't mention, I don't think, about this, is not only are they healthy now in this lobstering example, but they've been doing this for well over 100 years. It seems to me that makes it a reasonable candidate for sustainable practice. They're not perfect, but they've worked this out anyway, and they've done it for 100 years. Now, there's a little town in Spain that has arid conditions, highly variable water supply, and the irrigators, the farmers, have worked out a system for allocating that water. And there's so many disputes over the water, they have a weekly tribunal to work out all the disputes. So on the face of it, this system would never work, not for very long anyway. But the fact is, it's worked for 500 years, maybe possibly 1,000 years. And imagine if we go even a little further, how about the Nile River? That on some counts, the Egyptians figured out how to live with the annual floods, not against them. And they did that for 5,000 years. Isn't it possible that in examples like this, and so many that are all around us, that we can find the principles of sustainability to counter, as countervailing principles to the ones of the current degrading, ever-expanding economic order? So what those principles might be? Well, I'm sure everyone's heard about prevention and polluter pays and precaution, reverse onus. These are all important parts of it. But it seems to me that we, in this society in particular, we need principles that deal with one of the defining characteristics of this culture, namely excess. And not just the existence of excess, but the very celebration of excess. Okay? We need countervailing principles for that. And maybe restraint, respite, buffering are possibilities for that. Would it put under the rubric of sufficiency, doing well by doing a little bit less than the most possible. Thank you.
That was Dr. Thomas Prinsen. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. Our next speaker is Jack Santa Barbara.
I'm the executive director, or the director of the Sustainable Scale Project, something that was inspired by the work of Herman Daly and other ecological economists some years ago. And I've got a website called sustainablescale.org, which you're all welcome to not only have a look at, but contribute to. My task here today, in addition to moderating, is to say a few words, and I've kind of tried to organize my thoughts and what I'll talk about in three general areas. One, I've been asked to sort of sum up a bit, since this is a closing panel. Secondly, to address perhaps what's missing, both in terms of some of the issues that we need to be considering and how we form a common cause, and also groups that might be missing from our discussion and even participating. And then thirdly, to say a little bit about the future and how we proceed. I was kind of tempted to say, you know, to start out with saying this is the best of times, this is the worst of times. And I quickly realized I probably couldn't keep up the literary quality. but it does kind of feel like that, doesn't it, where we're really on the cusp of something very important. One of the things that's really struck me about the last 2.5 days here is the consensus that's evolved and from a variety of sources that capitalism is really the problem, as a core problem. And, you know, it seems to me that not very long ago it was politically incorrect to say this in public. And I'm really encouraged by the fact that we're finally saying it and that recognizing that it's actually essential. You know, we few here cannot be the only ones on the planet who get it. There's lots and lots and lots of others, individuals and organizations, and get it. And we have to find that common cause and bring that together, because that's a key issue. So that's one point. Secondly, we've talked a lot about the need for creativity and ingenuity in solving these enormous challenges that we have before us. And it's true that we need to do this, but we have to be very careful not to apply this ingenuity to the old growth paradigm. This is where we are led to false solutions. If we're going to really make a difference, we've got to develop a new paradigm. We have the choices now. One of the keys to that is going to be creating a new economic paradigm. And one of the things we've had a glimpse of here is that ecological economics, in fact, has a lot of the concepts and policies already developed and available that we need. Most of us in this movement, however, in this broad coalition that's required, are not yet sufficiently familiar with them. There's much that can be done with existing policies and regulations. We just need new goals and put them together in new ways. Tom Prinsen talked about the importance of sufficiency in terms of this whole issue of scale. There's really many, many different levels of sustainable scale, some of which will give us a lot in terms of material well-being and goods, and some of which will give us a lot more. So we have to kind of regulate that. And I want to use the F word, if I may. Am I allowed to say frugality? We need to raise frugality to a virtue. Okay? Frugality comes before efficiency. Very important principle, I think, to remember. Thirdly, I think we have to try to stop the excess, stop the exploitation of nature, of the poor, of the future. We've talked a bit about multinational corporations and their role. We've talked about, you know, their personal state, their legal status as a person, which is a problem. But we haven't really addressed the issue of their size and the power that they have because of their size. True economic competitiveness requires many small competitors. There are profound implications to this in terms of the amount of profits that can be generated, in terms of the relocalization of business. And if you don't have the profits, you can't corrupt governments as easily. So new antitrust legislation globally, I think, is another task that we haven't really addressed, but we need to think about and perhaps move forward. There's many other things that we need to do in terms of stopping the excess that have been talked about, reversing the perverse subsidies, taxing bads rather than goods, getting rid of debt-based currencies. Again, our money system is based on continued growth. We've got to get that changed if we're going to make a real difference. And, of course, getting rid of third-world debt. Another very important change is changing the patent laws. We've got to free information. If we're really going to make creativity let loose to meet these challenges, we've got to get rid of the patents and change them. Number four, I think we have to redefine development, and not just for the South, but for the North as well. We've got to move away from GDP as the measure, and as it's so connected with greenhouse gases. We have to begin thinking of development in terms of basic human needs, common human aspirations. There's been lots of talk about food, and I'm sure some of our panelists are going to talk about the essential nature of food as a basic need. We need to do this, and we need to ensure that in whatever fossil fuels, what little fossil fuels we continue using, have to be directed to ensuring that basic human needs for all of us are maintained. And the North needs this as much as the South. Another issue I like to address in a general framework is omissions. What's been missing from this discussion? Population has only got a little bit of attention, and that's a big, big issue. Business loves more population. It's the easiest way to increase your market. Just wait for people to, you know, grow more and buy more. We know that increasing female education and empowerment and availability of contraceptions has a huge impact in decreasing fertility. Yet the UN policy is more growth. They're looking for the economic transition. It's a very blunt, brutal instrument, economic growth and continued GDP. We've got to be much more precise in how we deal with that. An issue I don't think has been addressed at all is illegal activities. It was mentioned that the ozone hole is bigger than ever. Part of that is because of loopholes in the Montreal Protocol, but part of it is because there is so much illegal trading going on of CFCs. The deforestation that is contributing so much to climate change, much of that deforestation is illegal, yet the goods and the services that are provided enter into the legal system. So there's a global problem with illegal activity. So we do need a police and a military service to help enforce the commons, even the commons in very remote areas. But it has to be a policing service for the people, by the people, and of the people, not mercenaries for the rich. Another issue that has received little attention, and I think is really identified some undertones that are different in some of our approaches, is whether renewable energy is going to do it for us. You know, there's some speakers have spoken as though if we would only get on to renewable energy, we can continue the way we're going. There's others who have alluded to the fact that renewable energy is not likely to be able to replace fossil fuels. If renewable energy was so powerful and so good, we would have used it because we always use the good things first. Okay, we've used fossil fuels because they provide such incredible, unique energy resources. Powering down is about understanding net energy. It's about understanding the possibilities and the limitations of renewables. We have to be very careful. We can use renewables in unsustainable ways. We have to be very careful about that. Part of that, you know, green consumerism is all about producing things better. It's about how things are produced. It addresses very little about what is produced. And here's where I think we need to go back to basic human needs to put a focus on how we use our energy, the priorities that we're going to direct it to. I think how we're producing and consuming energy in the future is going to be absolutely key to our success. And what we produce is going to be even more important than how we produce it. There's been lots of talk about attractive visions, and I only want to emphasize the need for visions, plural. The common element is individuals' engagement and contribution to community. That's the key. No matter what the vision is, what is historically and culturally is locally appropriate, that's the key, I think, that generates the most human happiness and common good. One of the issues and topics missing from our discussion so far has been the connection with the faith-based communities. Many of them are getting these issues. It's a powerful force that I think, again, we need to connect with and bring into this coalition and open our thinking and our common cause with these groups. They're very large, and they have pulpits. They speak to lots of people. It's an alternative to the mass media that I think we're not using. Finally, I don't think I've heard, maybe I missed it, but any reference to nonviolence. To nonviolence as a value, to nonviolence as a tactic, to nonviolence as a strategy. This is key. And we tend to think, we need to raise awareness that that violence isn't only direct violence of war. There's the structural and cultural violence. It's actually more widespread, kills more people, destroys more communities and ways of life than direct violence. We have to understand structural violence in our institutions, in our society, in our businesses as being really key. There are literally hundreds of nonviolent tactics that Gene Sharp and others have identified. And if you're not familiar with them, I strongly encourage you to have a look. At the core of much of the nonviolence is withdrawing support from the oppressor. Withdrawing support from the oppressor. We need to stop buying corporate goods. You know, Buy Nothing Day needs to be expanded to Buy Nothing Week and Buy Nothing Month and Buy Nothing Year and Buy Nothing Life. Okay? It's you know, back to Gandhi's comment about production by the masses, not mass production. Also, we're going to have lots of conflicts in terms of the transitions that we're about to see. So the nonviolent strategies and tactics are going to be extremely important in that we learn how to do these things, that we plan carefully in nonviolent ways to deal with the many conflicts that are inevitable. Now, the opposite of violence is life enhancing. Violence destroys, the opposite is life enhancing. This is the key vision in my mind that can guide both the two directions that have been addressed in the last few days. One is the big picture, the global institution issues, especially the urgency of dealing with the climate issue. But the other, and this is not an either-or, this is what we have to learn, that it's not an either-or. We have to learn how to integrate these. The other, of course, is the community level, engaging in sustainable communities and community life. This is where it gets very personal. This is where it gets to be the change that we need to be. You know, Gandhi, I came across a Gandhian quote recently that said that when people lead, leaders follow. And that's very much, I think, the situation we're in. We have to demonstrate it. We have to lead with our own lives, our own community activities. Gandhi took on the big challenges. Racism, colonialism, empire. But wherever he went, he established communities based on nonviolence, based on common support, mutual support. And it was in these communities that he practiced personally and collectively the techniques that he then brought out to the big picture issues. He took down an empire and he enhanced the lives of millions and millions of people. This, I think, is our joyous task. Thank you. It's now my pleasure to actually to be up here with these folks that I've read about and admired for so many years. So our first speaker is Wes Jackson from the Land Institute. He, of course, is one of the pioneers of sustainable agriculture, co-founder and president of the Land Institute in Kansas back in 76. He's been at this for a while. Many, many books to his credit, New Roots for Agriculture and Becoming Native to This Place. He has the distinction of being named by Life magazine as one of the most important people, the 100 most important Americans of the 20th century, and is named by the Smithsonian magazine as one of the 35 who's made a difference, recipient of the Pew Conservation Scholars Award, MacArthur Fellowships, and the Right Livelihood Award, and the Alternative Nobel.
The assignment is to talk about what are the ingredients of systemic change. So I take assignment seriously. I'm going to do my best. Number one, we got to know the broad outline of the story. My kids used to say, "Can you explain that, Dad? And this time, start somewhere this side of the Big Bang." So in knowing the broad outline of the story, I think it's important to know that we life forms, whether we're whales or corn plants or redwoods, or mice, or humans are made of carbon. And going back 3.45 billion years, life forms on this planet go after energy-rich carbon. That's what we do. It probably was happening even before the cellular stage in the early energy wars. So we do that. And the second thing, starting about 10,000 years ago, one species, us, started going after pools of energy-rich carbon beyond the rate of replacement. Number one, the soil carbon with agriculture. That's where climate change had its beginning. And the second pool, after soil, forests. And that gave us a Bronze Age and an Iron Age and civilization. And the third, 250 years ago, coal. And then 1859, Drake's oil well. And then natural gas. And we're about to the end of the non-renewable carbon interlude. Don't dignify it by calling it an age. So what we are about, if you move to the next and only slide, what we are about is going after that carbon. And so far, Homo sapiens has not shown that it has gone beyond petri dish economics. And by that, if you have bacteria starting on a petri dish and you got sugar, it expands. That population expands. So if you, first of all, consider the 22-year-old, the graduate from college, has lived through 54% of all the oil ever burned. I'm 71. And in my first 22 years, I lived through 16% that amount. So the rate that this is coming on is fast. Now, anybody that died by 1930 never lived through a doubling of the human population. Anyone who is born in 2050 or after likely won't either. So we got the 120-year period. And if you look at that 120-year period on that slide, one finds petri dish economics. You got the energy and you just go for it. So the biggest challenge facing us, do we have the ability to practice the kind of restraint that no other species has ever had to do? And we got 3.45 billion years going against us. That's number one, the broad outline of the story. Number two, get the best information available and be prepared to cite your reference. The last thing we need is any more weenie-armed environmentalism. The quality of scientific literature ranges greatly. Science and nature have the most impact, both variously estimated to be between 10 and 20 times that of the top journals in the various specialties. And only a small percentage of the papers submitted to these journals are printed. These journals have been called the major gatekeepers of science. So when the National Academy of Sciences has a consensus about climate change, and when the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has a consensus, and when it's there in science and in nature, that has to have priority over Fox News. It also has to priority over Rush Limbaugh. And somehow that gets confused. So, but be sure you can cite your reference. Number three, when possible, avoid debates over different scientists' numbers. I say when possible. I'll give you an example. Biofuels from corn to run our cars. You don't only have to know one thing. 26 gallons of gasoline is the same number of calories that the average American eats in a year. So let's assume we don't eat for a year. And we turn all the food into ethanol. That's 2 gallons a month per person. That's for the postal worker. That's for the airplanes, the car, everything that involves that portable liquid fuel. So then let's take all the corn stalks and all the wheat straw and the peanut shells and the grass clippings. Now you got another 2 gallons a month. 26 gallons for the food. Another 26-gallon equivalent from all the so-called waste, and then stop all exports. Now you got another 1.5 to 2 gallons, 6 gallons a month. So we don't need to be talking about whether Pimentel and Patsik's numbers agree with somebody's numbers somewhere else. Just know a few simple things. Well, some say, but there's a big world. Okay, take all the rice of the world, take all the wheat of the world, take all the corn of the world, take all the soybeans of the world, which is about 2/3 of the total cropland of the world. Turn that all into ethanol. That's 14% of the U.S. vehicle consumption. We got to find these showstoppers so we can move on in our discussion and not get caught up in fine-tuning something that is so obvious. Number four, technological fundamentalism is on the increase. And technological fundamentalism is worse than religious fundamentalism. So you got to brace yourselves for happy talk and snake oil. In April, mid-April this year, New York Times, Thomas L. Friedman comes out and says in that special section that there is a cornucopia of abundance with renewables. Now, we got to watch that kind of talk. Someone that comes late to the issue is usually susceptible to happy talk. And so, among the thoughts of the technological fundamentalists are things like this. All we need to do is get more efficient with our technology. Well, here is an indication. The idea that necessity is the mother of invention is really the other way around. Invention has been the mother of necessity. There are a lot of things we didn't know we needed till we saw. So it's important to keep in mind William Stanley Jevons wrote the book, The Coal Question, 1865, where he did an analysis of industrial England and found that as industrial England got more efficient, it used more resources, particularly coal and iron. It's called Jevons' paradox. So now we have Walmart that is wanting to get more efficient with its fleet. Well, they'll open up more box stores with the savings. Greater efficiency without a cap. Greater efficiency without a cap leads to the use of more resources. So we got to watch that. Number five. This period of transition to renewables should be a very short period of economic growth. It is to be used to pave the way toward resilience. There may be a growth industry, say, in wind machines or photovoltaic panels in the early stages, but we need to realize so far it hasn't been climate change that's been destroying rainforests, destroying small towns and rural communities, giving us urban sprawl. It's energy. So to try to simply substitute for the energy that we have been using, it's hard to keep low entropic energy out of trouble. It's very hard to keep it out of trouble. It has a way of wanting to do something. So then number six, Jay Forrester, 40 years ago, he talked about the counterintuitive behavior of social systems. He's the one that trained that group that did the limits to growth study. And what Jay Forrester said, that people know intuitively where the leverage points are. And time after time, I've done an analysis of a company and I've figured out a leverage point. Then I've gone to the company and discovered that everyone's pushing it in the wrong direction. He then went on to explain that the classic example of the backward intuition is what stood behind that world model standard run. So what he found was that poverty and hunger, environmental destruction, resource depletion, urban deterioration, unemployment are all related. And those that were out to solve that, they had found the leverage point, but it was growth that was causing it rather than more growth that would be corrective. He had a whole list of problems in that area. Morris Behrman, the author of Dark Ages America, The Final Phase of Empire, published in 2006, he contends that the question before us mostly has to do with how much flexibility we have in making choices and acting on them. Every civilization, he says, is a package deal, and the configuration of that package dictates a trajectory imposed by the constraints of that deal. And some of those constraints may be positive, others may be negative. So when economics and population growth have been used to solve problems in the past, they've been the package deal, so to speak. So there's little wonder that we may fail to realize that the factors that made our civilization rise to power are the factors that may do it in. Now, here's the problem. For us to be where we are as a country today required that we rejected countless alternatives along the way. Behrman argues that collapse or divine decline can only be avoided if the alternatives have been repressed and not available to be incorporated in a dominant way of being. So when resistance to the alternatives is fierce, then we're destined to get where we're headed. Behrman and Forrester would both understand why it is that a consultant is called in when the going gets tough. And better than most of us, they can predict that usually when the business or whatever has reached the point in which it finally has the ability to listen, it's too late. The change is often only merely cosmetic. Number 8, I guess. Don't forget that the ecosphere is seamless. Carbon dioxide in the global commons should have told us this, but I have heard respected ecologists say that in order to save the wild biodiversity, we need to intensify agriculture where, as one put it, it's already screwed up. Well, we need to think about an agriculture where conservation is a consequence of production. And right now, agriculture is the number one destroyer of ecosystems. We're losing 24 million acres a year, according to the ecosystem assessment report. That is half the area of Kansas each year that's being lost to agriculture, and that means more encroachment. So, but don't presume that the ecosphere is seamless. For instance, we're dumping fertilizer and pesticides in the upper Midwest, 1,100 miles away downstream. There's a dead zone. And as a consequence, the fisheries go out. According to Nancy Rabelais and Gene Turner, there are probably 1,000 dead zones around the planet. Study number 9. Studies on neurological development and psychology suggest that when a falsehood is held, try not to confuse a falsehood with a myth, by the way. A myth is something rich and many layers in informing. Call it a falsehood or a lie, but don't dignify it by calling it a myth. Studies, that's a sermon, studies on neurological development and psychology suggest that when a falsehood is held, evidence counter to a person's belief being presented only intensifies the belief in the falsehood. We got to go over that very carefully and slowly. Because we think that once we've told them and presented the evidence, now their mind can change. But something we're not doing right. And it's important to remember Aristotle's 3 kinds of arguments. Logos, the rational argument. This is what the Enlightenment highlighted as essential for progress. The second, pathos. Well, logos is, let's say, our side has more men and better weapons than their side. We'll go to war and win. Pathos has to do with feeling. If we don't attack them, they'll come and steal our wives. And ethos has to do with the character of the speaker. How credentialed are you to talk about this? Now, we got to use all of these, but we got to remember that Aristotle himself recognized that logos is the weakest of all arguments. So don't presume that just because we've been logical. And then number 10, arguments are minimized if the underlying assumptions are clearly stated. What I find in most arguments is that the boundary of consideration does not overlap the boundary of causation. For example, as long as bushels per acre informed by export policies, the bottom line, then we're going to have nitrates in the water and pesticides in the water and soil erosion and overdrafting of fossil water. And finally, I think it's important to start painting a vision for the future. Go home and sit down and write your vision for the future. John Kennedy put a man on the moon in a decade. May have been a bad idea. I think it was. I don't think we've been to the moon, quite frankly. What they did is have a figure surrounded by an Earth atmosphere in close proximity to the moon. Now, if you think that's a detail, unzip the suit. I mean, this is just one of the biggest lies going. The carrying capacity of the moon is zero. Kennedy inspired everybody. Martin Luther King had a dream, and we've got to have a dream, recognizing that embedded in that dream is to figure out to build an economy that is more like nature's economy, the natural ecosystems, a prairie, an alpine meadow, a forest. They all feature material recycling and run on contemporary sunlight. Embedded in those ecosystems is the prototype for a different economic order and away from petri dish economics. Thank you.
That was Wes Jackson.
He's one of the founders of two centers in Delhi, New Delhi, India, one called Dialogue of the People and the other Intercultural Resources. Each of these centers is promoting exchanges between non-party political formations and concerned scholars and other citizens from India and around the world. His background in physics, communications, and sociology, and as a political organizer in ecological, cultural, and human rights issues. He's president of the International Group for Grassroots Initiatives, and his critiques of contemporary economic, cultural development and the relationship of nature, culture, and democracy, developmental displacement, people's governance, and social movements have been widely published. So I think we're going to hear some very interesting things from Smithu Kothari.
Thank you, Jack. It's an honor and a privilege to have been invited here and to be part of this remarkable teaching. I would like to start by sharing two stories of movements and processes that I have been personally involved in. There is a village in one of the over 500,000 villages in India called Mendha Lekha in central India. 30 years ago, it was rendered even more vulnerable than the long process of colonization of India had rendered it. By a decision by the Indian Forest Department, which controls all of India's forests, to take charge and to start selective felling in that forest that was at the center of their subsistence economy. The community got mobilized. They got in touch with some of us, and we built a large coalition of support. And with that wider support, the community took a decision to say enough. They blocked the approach roads to the village. They blocked the approach roads to the forest. They told whoever came that if they had to be moved, they would have to be bulldozed. There were several police actions, and they stood their ground. And eventually, the Forest Department receded. That started a slow and a very patient process of restoration. Today, the forests of Mendha Lekha are thriving. Its lands and lakes providing abundantly, and it generates a healthy surplus. It has inspired over 100 villages around and countless activists who have taken its message beyond its borders. It is also part of a major national movement that after 150 years of struggle has secured a dramatic legislation 7 years ago that recognizes their right to self-rule. 80 million people in India now have this right to self-rule. This legislation, its language, the process that led up to it has significantly, at least importantly, I should say, not significantly, importantly influenced the drafting of the Declaration of Indigenous Peoples, specific language from the self-rule legislation in India, brought through the struggles of its indigenous and tribal people, have contributed to that declaration. The community thrives because it has also affirmed political autonomy, selectively delinking itself. And I know that there has been some criticism in the last 3 days, and I know that there are skeptics here who feel that these corners of our planet that selectively delink can, given the nature of capitalist penetration, given the nature of the invasive forces, can be overrun very quickly. But the important thing about villages like Mendalekha and the movements that led to the legislation of self-rule was that they have been integral to the building of a major alliance of friends and groups and support groups and other movements around the country. They have managed also, interestingly enough, the process that led up to the legislation being passed was to actually convince 150 members of our parliament to actually be present in parliament a day before Christmas Day, when most people had gone home, to see that this legislation was passed. Those alliances, and they come together under a national group called the Campaign for Survival and Dignity, hopefully will ensure that the Mendalekhas, with their selective with their autonomy, and with a little stone outside their village that says this is a self-rule village, will not get overrun. They remain a major inspiration for the work that we do. The second story. There is also a village of traditional fish workers in Kerala. Over 25 years ago, mechanized fishing boats owned by powerful corporations and armed with a license from the central government started trawling off the coastline where this village was located. Fish for this community was at the heart of their subsistence. Much more importantly, and as you saw with that photograph of the fish worker in Maine throwing the lobster overboard, these are communities whose traditional knowledge systems, they have lived in this area for at least 1,500 years sustainably. Their traditional knowledge systems are among the most sophisticated on the planet. They know exactly when, in which time of day, year, and what climate do they have to go out into the ocean, and what part of the ocean will give them how much harvest, when they need to let the sea and the fish be untouched. These knowledge systems have come down through intergenerationally, and the 80 million people who belong to our tribal and indigenous communities, or the other millions of people who are part of our farming communities and fish workers communities, have this depth of knowledge system that has been so brutally disrespected and insulted in the dominant economic processes. And in that sense, therefore, their relationship to the sea and to the fish is an integral part of their identity, of their culture. Work that people like me and others have done suggests that this integral relationship between nature and culture, that the cultural plurality of a country like India is significantly a outcome of the natural plurality within which people resided and built their lives and livelihoods. This particular village blockaded, and they took their boats out into the sea, and they didn't allow the trawlers to come in. They were beaten back. They mobilized other communities across the coast of India and decided to come to Delhi. They sat in Delhi for a fast that lasted 21 days. 170 people sat on a fast for 17 days. And at the end of it, they at least got an assurance from the government that it will look into their demand that those licenses must be cancelled. It took 3 years of sustained mobilization and struggle for those licenses to be cancelled. They inspired a movement which now has 6 million members. It's the largest social and political movement in Asia. And it's still vibrant and it's still strong. There is a lot of pressure on it, both from the forces of neoliberal globalization, but also from within the community, particularly amongst the younger generation that wants to semi-mechanize and mechanize. And a major debate is going on in the community at the moment on how to, or whether they will, and if they do, how to make those transitions. These movements are at the heart, at the center of powerful currents of surplus-generating, self-reliant communities that represent some of the most important solutions to the triple crisis. They're part of 300 million people, half of the ecosystem people in India. 65% of India still lives in its rural areas. 300 million people, half of our ecosystem people, who live largely sustainable livelihoods. It's becoming more and more difficult. They are becoming more and more vulnerable, but they still are living within the regenerative principles of the planet. That's the good news. The bad news is that India is under siege. We are experiencing a social, cultural, and ecological crisis overwhelming in scale and pace of growth. There is a middle-class euphoria about the economic resurgence of the country. The 9% growth in the last few years is blinding them, and the power of consumerism is blinding them to the adverse impacts that this process is creating. The media celebrates when Merrill Lynch and Warburg Pincus announced that India is the best destination in the world to invest money. 26% of foreign direct investment in India last year was in real estate. The market capitalization of one of the biggest real estate companies, supported by financially, they have shares of three Wall Street firms, the market capitalization of this company went up from $600 million to $45 billion in 3 years. There is a massive process of invasion and loot that is going on at the moment. The last 16 years of the present phase of economic globalization has intensified this process of invasion and loot. Over 1 million people are being displaced every year by these processes of planned development, many from the relatively self-reliant, secure communities that I spoke of earlier. There's been a significant rise in social conflicts and violence. There's a significant rise in the extinction and vulnerability of cultures and languages. India is the center of 5,000 languages and dialects. And in the last 10 years alone, 160 languages are on the verge of extinction. And there's also simultaneously, and this we've heard from many other parts of the world, is a very rapid privatization of our commons. The World Bank has supported 17 projects in India in the last 3 years to privatize water supply. We've pushed them back in about half a dozen of them, but the others are going through. While we must understand the symptoms of this present invasion and actively respond to them, now more than ever there is a need to address the root causes of this crisis. The ideology that drives these people, that create these alliances between powerful international institutions, corporations, international financial institutions, and our economic elites. If you look at what we call the revolving door phenomenon, that the Prime Minister of India, the Finance Minister of India, 17 of the 31 senior officials of our finance finance and commerce ministries have at one stage or the other worked in the World Bank or the IMF. If you actually were to make a map of the finance ministers and senior economic and financial officials of third world countries across the world, this would be a common trend running right through. So it's not something that happens by accident. It's an extremely well thought out, planned process of building partnerships of the willing to continue to colonize the planet. And I mean, and this is interesting. What is interesting, particularly for this conference, and this has been referred to several times in the last 3 days, that if you look at the language and look at the content of the recent reports of the Interplanetary Inter-Parliamentary Committee on Climate Change, and Daphne Weisram of the Institute for Policy Studies, and I did an article some months ago, which was published in India and then widely circulated. It had very little impact. I did get invited to a government committee, and I did mention to them that I'm not a scientist. There are other scientists in the country who have done much better work, other scientists in the world that have done much better work, and they need to be invited to come and discuss these issues. But the gravity of that report, which is that just in 30 years, two of the subcontinent's greatest rivers that have been at the crucible of our civilizations, the Brahmaputra and the Ganga, will become seasonal rivers. It's staggering just to think of the consequences ecologically, politically, culturally, that development will have. And yet, what you see in our elites, and we have had now several open dialogues with them, we've had engagements in the media with them, what you see in our elites, by members of the government and in the media, is a response that at best is that the West is primarily responsible, and therefore they are responsible to power down are on a trajectory of not just economic resurgence, but also of becoming a superpower. If they are a superpower, we need to become a superpower too. And at worst, if someone asks the government of India to act in the interest of what the logic of these reports state, the worst response is that please do not insult our sovereignty. The language of India becoming a superpower, it's becoming heady for a lot of people, very powerful people in our business community. There has been a rapid rise of Indian transnational corporations, as all of you are aware. They're buying hotels and companies all over the world. There is a discussion between Indian elites in Russia and in China of building a new power block of three new superpowers in that part of the world, creating genuinely, therefore, a multipolar world from the present unipolar one. It's frightening talk, at least for people like me. But it is very much part of this resurgent sensibility that is becoming so pervasive amongst not just the elites, but amongst our very rapidly growing middle classes, 250 million people at the moment. And I see this, therefore, also as a reflection of a profound irony, that at a time in which in our interpersonal lives, in our workplace, in our families, we have internalized so deeply the ethic of the democratic spirit, of the need to look each other with dignity at the other, to need to look at each other with respect and care, we have allowed a largely unaccountable and thoroughly undemocratic economic and political system to so profoundly dominate over us. And it's us who belong to this, who call ourselves free people. We call ourselves people who have liberated themselves out of the chains of colonialism that had, in fact, in India at least, we were colonized for almost two centuries. And yet we have allowed a slow and at times an aggressive penetration of some of the most undemocratic institutional systems, financial systems, to so centrally dominate almost every single decision. The latest country assistance strategy of the World Bank projects itself as being a knowledge provider. It's spending 17% of its annual spending in India of $6 billion a year now on funding research in its institution, in its universities, in its independent research institutions, in the government-supported research institutions. The bank actually creates this entire system of paradigm maintenance of the development discourse on the planet. How do we respond when we are faced with this kind of challenge? Where will the action come from? There's enormous urgency to the tasks that we face. Where will the action come from? They will come from the communities affirming self-rule, from the fish workers who are defending their lives, livelihoods, and knowledge systems. They will come from the movements and their alliances, from the communities struggling to deepen democracy in Latin America. They will come from those communities in Totnes and Ohio and thousands of other places in the West that are seeking to rebuild communities. But in addition to that, there are four urgent tasks. One is to not shirk away from challenging power. not shirk away from subverting power. We have gone and raided the office of the World Bank in India against the wishes of many of our colleagues and friends. We have painted its walls saying, World Bank, go home. We insisted when Wolfensohn came to India, we'd send a letter saying we would like to meet him. And he said, well, send in a delegation, or someone in his office said, send in a delegation. And we said, no, we are not sending a delegation. There are 700 of us from all over the country who were sitting representing numerous movements. Finally, after a two-hour standoff, we blocked that road. Wolfensohn had to come and sit with us on the ground, not for 15 minutes, which were given to us, but for 2.5 hours. It is important to challenge power. It's important to subvert power. But it is also equally important to build countervailing power. And we can do it. Each one of us can do it where we are. Two, to democratize the international institutions. It has to be a major task, continuing task. It's been going on for a long time. Democratizing the corporations, scaling them down, democratizing international financial institutions, thinking, rethinking new ways of the Global Bank of the South that is being proposed now is one such proposal, but there must be numerous others because that's still relatively conventionally framed. Third, to generate and participate in the generation of new spaces, new institutions, new sources of livelihood and subsistence and sustenance based on moral, ecological, and holistic principles through a continuous process of action and reflection. There's need for deep personal introspection on our own consumption and our own footprint. To realize your own potential to make change, one of the greatest challenges, as Gandhi used to say, is the decolonization of the mind, of how we view the world and how we view nature. 6 centuries we've been colonized, and 6 centuries of that colonization of the mind, it's a profound task, and I think we've only just begun. Gandhi popularized a profound principle, the principle of Swaraj. Not just political independence, but liberation and self-rule, with 3 very important embedded values. The value of self-respect, the value of self-realization, and the value of self-responsibility. In our movements, we continue to seek to internalize these with great humility. This is a profoundly political and personal challenge that lies ahead of us, including the challenge of restoring, regenerating, and healing this horribly wounded planet in which we live. Thank you.
That was Smithu Kothari speaking at a teach-in confronting the triple crisis held in September 2007 by the International Forum on Globalization. It brought together an interdisciplinary international group of activists and researchers to address the transformation to sustainable practices, to halt and reverse the destruction of the ecosphere, and to meet the needs of people and other life on this planet. You can find out more about the International Forum on Globalization at ifg.org. Thanks for listening to another episode of Unwelcome Guests. You can download an MP3 of today's show, as well as nearly 9 years of previous shows, at the archives at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.
You still catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle.